KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in East Oakland.
Cleveland Heights.
I live in Adams Point.
West Oakland.
Coming up, what does the Trump administration's statement about DACA mean for the children of undocumented immigrants here in the Bay?
The immigrant community is in a panic right now. They're really feeling that they're in the crosshairs of this administration.
Then we'll travel between California's Central Valley and Punjab, India, to see how the Green Revolution has transformed agriculture and immigration.
Balveed says out of the 50 farming families in this village, 15 have left for other countries.
How a community of Punjabi farmers ended up in California. Our three-part international reporting project begins today on Cross Currents. Stay tuned. This morning's announcement about the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, has had strong ripple effects throughout the Bay Area. Right now, there's a protest going on at the Federal Building in San Francisco. The Immigrant Legal Resource Center is based in the city. Last week, the group issued a community advisory entitled, What Do I Need to Know If the DACA Program Ends? It details information about work permits, ID cards, travel, and rights under the Constitution. One of the authors is the group's deputy director, Sally Kinoshita. After today's statement by U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, Sally spoke with KALW's news director, Ben Trefney, from her office.
Do you have any idea in California or the Bay Area specifically how many people have received benefits under Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals?
Yeah, the government releases data on a quarterly basis, and the latest data we have, which is as of March 31st this year, is that in the state of California, over 424,000 individuals have been approved for DACA in our state alone. The government does not release data on the regional or county level.
So that's a real disproportionate amount compared to the national numbers then. California has a huge percentage.
That's right. I mean, just in general, the state of California has about a quarter of the undocumented population in the country. And then here in California, we have a large percentage of the DACA recipients, largely because there have been whole communities that have been able to work together to help people apply for this benefit. So there's some feeling in the community that there's safety in numbers. It definitely helps when people know others who've benefited from the program and have seen all the kinds of benefits that flow from having DACA.
Can you tell me the backstory of somebody with whom you've worked or your organization has worked that this will affect?
You know, last week there were about 400 business leaders that came out in support of DACA because they work with DACA recipients. The organization I work with is no different. We've had a number of DACA recipients employed here at the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. And what we've seen since President Trump started threatening the DACA program in his presidential campaign, as well as since he has become president, is really an unprecedented level of anxiety. I've been practicing immigration law for almost 20 years, during which time we've already seen record high deportations, even under the Obama administration. But the kind of targeting that we've seen more recently and the talk of canceling DACA has meant that as an immigration attorney, I'm getting calls about how to help people's mental health.
So DACA is only about 5 years old. I'm wondering, what was different about life for children of undocumented immigrants before President Barack Obama passed it in June 2012?
Prior to DACA, there were, in states like California, thousands and thousands of undocumented students who were doing well in school, but upon finishing high school realized that without a Social Security number, it was difficult to apply to college. They could not access federal financial aid at a time when college was reaching sky-high prices and becoming unaffordable. They also did not have the alternative to work because they didn't have a work permit. So what we had was a whole class of good students, hard workers that had no way to plug in, which is one of the things that DACA addressed, was how can we take members of our community who are Americans by every measure except for a piece of paper and ensure that we have not only created opportunities for them, but for the rest of American society that really needs that kind of brain power, labor, community members, and family members in our society.
That's Sally Kinoshita. She's Deputy Director of the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. Now let's listen to what President Obama said back in 2012 when he signed an executive order establishing Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or what he called the DREAM Act. Here he is at his White House press conference.
Now, let's be clear. This is not amnesty. This is not immunity. This is not a path to citizenship. It's not a permanent fix. This is a temporary stopgap measure that lets us focus our resources wisely while giving a degree of relief and hope to talented, driven, patriotic young people.
So it wasn't a permanent fix to President Obama at the time, and now President Trump is saying he wants to send it back to Congress. Did you think that DACA was something that in its form could have been made permanent or should be made permanent, or is it something that legislators should work out?
DACA was never the solution that we needed. It was a stopgap remedy at the time that was within the authority of a president to enact. But it didn't, it's exactly why we're in this limbo situation now, where the undocumented young people who benefited from it never really had the kinds of protections that put them on a permanent path to citizenship or assured that they could continue to grow roots here, because it could at any moment be taken away, as we have seen is the case. So a permanent solution through a legislative fix, in other words, a bill that becomes a law, is exactly what we need at this point, not just for those who qualify for DACA, but for their families and the 11 million undocumented people that we have in the United States.
So we'll see if Congress is able to work through this. They've obviously had a lot of trouble pushing through legislation in recent years. But meanwhile, if DACA ends, what kind of impact do you think it will have in the Bay Area, socially, economically, and politically?
So certainly the end of DACA is going to have economic and financial implications. 800,000 workers taken off of the labor force over the course of the next 2 years means billions of dollars in lost tax revenue, as well as what these DREAMers and DACAs were contributing to the gross domestic product. So we'll see definitely a financial impact as workers have to come off and new workers have to be hired and trained. But we've also seen a tremendous social impact. The immigrant community is in a panic right now. They're really feeling, like many communities, poor communities and communities of color, that they're in the crosshairs of this administration. The impact on the mental health of students and their families, and also the coworkers and community members who live amongst DACA recipients and who, you know, we work together, we worship together, we go to school together. The impact has been really rippling throughout the community, not just on DACA recipients themselves.
Do you think that, considering this was essentially a campaign pledge of President Trump, that him giving some time for Congress to work out a solution is fair?
You know, this was a problem created by Donald Trump by making it a campaign promise that he said he would act upon his first day in office. He created an expectation that came back to get him. It was his own party that challenged him and set today as the deadline under which he had to respond.
Because of the threatened lawsuit.
Because of the threatened lawsuit. One of the reasons for the delay that the administration has put out there is that they're giving 6 months to Congress to act. And we actually agree with the administration in that case that Congress needs to act to create a legislative solution to this issue. However, at the same time, we noticed that the administration wasn't clear about what that solution would be. There was no support for a specific bill, no specific commitment to take leadership to ensure that we see a bill within that time period. So we're left with wondering what does happen at the end of that 6 months if, again, Congress cannot act in time.
That's Sally Kinoshita, Deputy Director of the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. She spoke with KALW's News Director, Ben Trefney. You can find a link to their advisory called What Do I Need to Know If the DACA Program Ends at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Didar Singh Bains is known as the Peach King of California. He's from Punjab, a region in South Asia that was split between India and Pakistan in 1947. Just over a decade later, Didar arrived in the U.S. with $8 in his pocket. He became a farm worker, and today he's one of the largest peach farmers in the world. Didar is part of a sizable community of Punjabi farmers in California's Central Valley, especially in Yuba, Sutter, Fresno, and Kern counties. These farmers come from a region famous for its fertile land and its farmers. So how and why did they end up in California? KALW's Kavalroop Kaur Singh has the story.
To find an almond, you have to crack open the layers that conceal it. You have to get through the green leathery exterior shell to the rough brown interior shell deep in the center. There, you'll discover the small sweet white nut, something to chew on, like a kernel of truth waiting to be found. Sandeep Singh is cracking open almonds on his 70-acre farm in Tracy, California. He picks one off a tree to show me the inside.
Mm-hmm. While the nuts on the tree, mm-hmm. It's called a shell, the outer shell, the green one.
California produces 4/5 of the world's almonds. Almonds are a $5 billion industry for the state, and Sandeep is now a small part of it.
These are young trees. These are like 4th leaves. They grow really big.
Sandeep marvels at how tall his trees will eventually be. He says they'll grow up to 3 times their current height, and they're already 12 feet tall. Taller trees mean a lot more almonds, which is good for business.
You're looking at, I guess, is the only business in the world. It used to pay itself in 2 years. It was a serious money.
But it isn't easy money. Almond farming is costly, and it's hard work.
I'm looking to buy that, all the tools or stuff for harvesting, because it costs a lot.
Sandeep immigrated to the U.S. from the state of Punjab in northern India when he was 19 years old. He sought economic opportunities and chose not to go to college, but to work instead.
I really wanted to help out my family back in Punjab, my dad, my grandparents, and my brother, my sister.
He took a job as a construction worker, then as a taxi driver in New York, then as a truck driver in California. But 3 years ago, he decided to return to his agricultural roots. Sandeep may be a young farmer in California, but he comes from a family that's been farming for generations. His father was a farmer, his grandfather was a farmer, his great-grandfather was a farmer, on and on, as far back as he can go. Actually, his family is still farming today, on their ancestral land in the state of Punjab in northern India. So why did Sandeep come to California to farm when he could have just farmed where he grew up? To answer that, we'll go to Punjab, to the small village where Sandeep was born. I'm standing in the village of Pero Munna, near the city of Ludhiana in Punjab, India. Sandeep's ancestors came and settled in this village about 300 years ago. They've been farming ever since. Today, on their 17 acres of land, they grow rice and wheat, like most farmers in Punjab. But Balveer Singh, Sandeep's father, says they've been struggling to make ends meet. He says, we can hardly make enough money to survive by farming. After the harvest is over, when we're balancing our accounts, we find that we barely have enough left to eat. We aren't able to save money for anything else. Balveer says that's partly because of how expensive farming has become in the last half century. It wasn't always that way. Back when we had a well on our farm, he says, I used to operate it myself. It didn't cost much. We had two oxen that pulled water from the well. We would feed them grain, lentils, chickpeas, sugar, whatever we had at home. We never had to buy anything for them. Fifty years ago, that's how irrigation used to happen in Punjab, with water wheels attached to wells, pulled round and round by oxen. Today, most farmers in Punjab use tube wells. Tube wells are long pipes that bore down into aquifers deep underground and pump the water up, supplying it through pipes to the farmland. Sandeep's brother, Virinder Singh, shows me the tube well on their family farm. Virinder opens the door to a dark room filled with switches used to operate the tube well. When his family installed it back in 1965, the water was 15 feet below the ground. Now, Virinder says, they have to drill down 200 feet to get their water, and the water levels continue to recede. Balveer says, in the next 20 years, we may not have any water left. But how can water disappear in Punjab? The soil-rich state is full of rivers. It's actually named for the five rivers that flow through it. It's historically known as one of the most fertile regions on Earth. 60% of Punjabis work in agriculture, and their small state provides much of the food for one of the largest nations on Earth. Virinder Singh and I take a walk on their family's farmland. All around me, rice plants sit in fields flooded with water for miles and miles. Virinder tells me they will sit like this for almost 5 months, using water 24 hours a day. But Balveed, Virinder's father, remembers a time when they didn't grow rice at all. He says, we used to grow cotton, corn, wheat, and sugarcane. There was no rice back then. Things started to change in 1965. That year, they had their first tube well installed. And it was the year the first high-yielding varieties of rice were introduced to Punjab. The seeds of the Green Revolution were planted.
A helpful way to think of the Green Revolution is as a capitalist marketing campaign that sort of got out of hand. My name is Eric Holt Jimenez. I'm the executive director of Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy in Oakland, California.
To understand the Green Revolution, we must go back to the years immediately after World War II. The U.S. had stockpiles of chemicals, tanks, and other equipment left over from the war. The chemicals were turned into pesticides and fertilizers. The tanks were turned into tractors. The government and banks gave out loans to farmers to buy this equipment and increase production.
And we did, incredibly. And that was very important because that extra food production not only fed the United States, it fed Europe.
In 1944, the Rockefeller Foundation funded the scientist Norman Borlaug to go to Mexico. He developed high-yielding varieties of wheat called miracle wheat. Around the same time, the corporations that produce agricultural equipment were trying to expand. Eric says this is how the Green Revolution began.
The Green Revolution was a campaign to export not just the products, but the form of agricultural production to the Third World.
Punjab was flooded with high-yielding seeds, chemical fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, advanced farming equipment, and scientists trained by U.S. universities. As food production grew, Norman Borlaug was hailed as the scientist who would end world hunger. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970.
The Green Revolution has not yet been won. It is true that the tide of battle against hunger has changed for the better during these past 3 years. But tides have a way of flowing and ebbing again.
Whole nations bought into Norman Borlaug's ideas. Balveer Singh remembers when India invested in miracle wheat. In 1966, the government bought thousands of tons to increase the nation's wheat production. He says the first seed we ever got from a foreign country came from Mexico. It was for wheat. I ask him if it actually helped produce more wheat. He says it did for a while, but today it doesn't really make a difference. We have to spend so much money, he says. We get more wheat, but it costs so much to grow. So even if there's more wheat, what's the point? His son, Varinder, agrees. The cost of production has increased so much, but the price of our crops hasn't, he says. Miracles can have consequences. More food means more dependence on water, chemical fertilizers, and pesticides in order to grow crops. Balveed says most farmers in his village have become indebted, and that debt continues to grow. On average, each farmer in my village is about 2 million rupees in debt, he says. For some, it may be 5 million, for some, 1.5 million, but 2 million is about the average. That's more than $30,000. And this is in a state where the average annual income is about $1,000 per person. Balveed says the land has become dependent on pesticides. The first pesticide stopped working after a while. Then we had to buy more expensive ones, he says. Then those stopped working. Every 5 or 6 years, we have to buy new ones. Eric Holt Jimenez calls this the pesticide treadmill. It's when farmers are taking out credit in order to buy more and more pesticides, more and more fertilizer, and getting diminishing returns.
So there's a cost-price squeeze between more and more costs, higher and higher costs for the factors of production, and then lower and lower price for the goods that the farmers sell. That's a characteristic of people who are swept up in the Green Revolution and the capitalist food system.
That's what happened with Balveed and his potato crop. When we grew potatoes, it cost us 180 rupees per bag, Balveed says. But they were selling at 150. Varinder adds, it costs us more to grow the potatoes than we can sell them for. The Ludhiana district, where Balveed and his family live, received lots of attention during the Green Revolution. 50 years ago, it was thought to be one of the areas with the most potential for success. But now, people want to leave. Balveed says out of the 50 farming families in this village, 15 have left for other countries. Varinder adds, and everyone would leave if they could. I ask Balveed if he wants the rest of his family to leave and join his son, Sandeep, in Modesto. I would want us to, he says. But who would stay and take care of our ancestral land?
All right, dear. I'm going to pull it out because I'm going to load it up and take it to the shop.
Almost 10,000 miles away, Sandeep Singh tends to his farm in California's Central Valley. He sends money home to his family regularly. He even helped them build the house they live in now. He says his peers who left Punjab are doing well.
If you go down south to Fresno, Bakersfield, you see every other farm is owned by Punjabis.
But he says that those left in Punjab aren't doing so well. Farmers like Sandeep have left the country where the Green Revolution was carried out. They've come here instead to the country that created it. And more are coming. This may be one result of the Green Revolution that its founders never expected. For Cross Currents, I'm Kamalroop Kaur Singh.
That story was made possible in part by the International Center for Journalists. It's the first in a series of stories about Punjabi farmers. Go to our website, klw.org, and click Cross Currents to find out more.
And that's it for today's show. Our Cross Currents team includes China Armstrong, Raquel Maria Dillon, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Marina Poole, Corinne Smith, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Jackie Sajiko. And a big welcome to our new Audio Academy class, Christine Nguyen, Amber Miles, and Lilia Vega. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.